Put that number in perspective, normal high is 42. The record high for this date is 68. That was set in 1879, so possibility of tying it, maybe even breaking it. Tonight, sunset 6:52, clear, windy, and mild, a low of 43. Some winds up to 30 miles per hour. Tuesday, sunny, windy, and seasonal, a high of 46. Again, winds up to 30 miles per hour. Right now, wind southwest at 5, 51 degrees for Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. Morning Show with Greg Berg on the way next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Recent events have drawn the world's attention back to the extraordinary figure of Volodymyr Zelensky, the leader of Ukraine. And I thought it was a good time to replay what I regard as one of the most memorable interviews I was privileged to conduct back in 2024. That interview with author Simon Schuster about his book, The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader, the leader in question, Volodymyr Zelensky. Simon Schuster first met Mr. Zelensky back in 2019 and continued to follow him closely. And Schuster was granted extraordinary access to Zelensky even in the tumultuous days immediately following Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine 3 years ago. And it allows Simon Schuster to tell this incredible story in a fashion that most would never dream to be even possible. The book is published by William Morrow & Company, again titled The Showman. One of the choices you make is for the book to not unspool in just kind of a smooth, unbroken chronological arc, but in a sense we begin in the heart of the invasion, but then in various chapters we are popping back to earlier times in Zelensky's life and career. I can kind of guess what the answer is, but I'm curious to hear it from you, why you wanted to construct the book in this kind of way.
Mm-hmm. It's I think, not to strain the reader's patience too much. It is a wartime biography, so I'd say the bulk of the book is focused on the war. More than half of it focuses on the period of the full-scale invasion, what was happening at that time, in the first year of the invasion, and kind of the months leading up to it. But it's still also a biography, so we do have to cover the points about where he came from, his career in show business, to kind of understand some of the character traits that he developed over the course of his career in show business and how they then were useful to him in the context of the war. I think that's a kind of important through line that you see throughout the book, but I didn't want to go chronologically through that story because it would force the reader to wait, 150 pages or so of his early life before we get to the action, so to speak, of the invasion itself. So that's why we kind of interweave the chapters there and the recollections of President Zelensky, his wife, his close childhood friends, his business partners from show business, their accounts, their recollections, their memories of him and his work from his earlier life, pre-politics, are kind of interwoven among the chapters describing the war and his political career.
We've already mentioned the fact that you have covered this part of the world for some years, and I'm just curious if there is anything in particular that has led to this being your primary journalistic beat, if you will.
Yeah, so I was born in the Soviet Union. I was born in a suburb of Moscow, and my family fled the Soviet Union as refugees in 1989 when I was 6 years old, and I grew up in San Francisco. but in a Russian-speaking neighborhood of Soviet immigrants. So all of my friends growing up were Russian-speaking. We spoke Russian at home. You know, later in life, that, of course, gave me a language in common with President Zelensky, who's also a Russian speaker. But in journalism, language is essential. I mean, it's so valuable to have a second language that you can communicate in and then kind of write in English but do interviews in Russian. That is a very valuable thing. It allowed me to be a kind of bridge between the cultures, a bridge between the countries, you know, explaining the former Soviet Union to an English-speaking audience. So as soon as I finished college in California, I moved back to Moscow. I still have some family there. I still had some family there at the time who helped me kind of get settled and adjusted. And I started working as a reporter for different publications, the Associated Press, Reuters, and then on to the kind of magazines as a freelancer, American magazines. And it was really the language that threw me into that world, because I was able to, you know, speak Russian without an accent. You know, I could understand the jokes. I could understand the humor, the kind of the meaning between words, and try to translate that and bring it to English-speaking audiences. That's basically how I made my career. There was no shortage of interesting stories and events happening in Russia and Ukraine and the former Soviet space throughout my career. I mean, there's always something going on. I think the last years have been especially tragic and important in terms of focusing the world's attention on these countries. But there's always, you know, Vladimir Putin has always been a subject of fascination for the West, and I've covered his career, his descent into authoritarianism, you know, since the beginning of my time in Moscow. I moved there in 2006, so ever since then I've been, you know, focusing on this beat, and it's all thanks to the language skills.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Simon Schuster about his fascinating new book called The Showman: Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Volodymyr Zelensky. We do need to shift to the earlier part of his life for just a few minutes. And one of the things that you explore in your book is how Zelensky's parents certainly had, and especially his father, had very different professional aspirations for their son. And they were especially at the outset not at all excited about this notion of him exploring the world of comedy and entertainment. Tell us a little bit about those tensions and how Zelensky found himself in a world so alien to that of his mother and father.
Yeah, his mother and father, you know, had kind of classic career paths for Soviet citizens of their generation. His father worked in close to the field of mathematics, especially cybernetics and computer science. He worked in developing automated systems for managing mines, especially copper mines. And his mother was an engineer and later an accountant. So, you know, pretty classic white-collar careers for Soviet citizens, and I think they had the same in mind for their son, Volodymyr Zelensky, but an only child, so they were quite intent on giving him the opportunities to succeed in the Soviet context. But what happened was the Soviet Union began to crumble, and all of the you know, social realities that had formed his parents' generation didn't really apply so much to President Zelensky's generation. He was really the product of an era of change. You know, when he was just started going to school in the late 1980s in Ukraine, the Soviet Union was already basically broke. Its experiment in socialism had failed. And he was coming of age in a period of extreme change, a transition to capitalism, the sudden opening up of the media to freedom of information. And one thing that really defined his early years was the appearance of comedy on television. There was a particular kind of comedy. It's more like a vaudeville style, sketch acts and improv, that was extremely popular on Soviet TV. It appeared in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, under Mikhail Gorbachev, who opened the Soviet Union to a lot more freedom and a lot more, you know, was much more open and kind of progressive as a reformer than his predecessors in leading the Soviet Union. And he opened up Soviet television to these new formats, such as comedy. And President Zelensky and his friends watched these shows obsessively, and they began to form their own kind of comedy troupe as kids. And this defined their childhood growing up. This was an obsession. This was all they did all the time, all their free time that their parents and their schools allowed them. And the parents looked at this a little bit with some suspicion. You know, they were more of a different generation, more traditionalist, I guess. And they thought it was a nice hobby, a cute thing for him to be doing, these kind of improv acts, but they certainly didn't see it as a career. Ultimately, they convinced him to go to law school, and he did complete his law degree in Ukraine while also performing as a comedian in his college years and high school years. But he had no interest in pursuing law as a career. He found it extremely boring. He once told a story of, you know, going to his first and really only trial in Ukraine in the 90s when he was finishing his law degree, and he said, you know, where's the performance? He had seen kind of American movies where lawyers perform and argue before a jury and so on. None of this was going on. It was very formulaic, very boring. And he said, I'm not doing this. And he went right back to comedy, and he pursued it as a career against the wishes of his family. But so it goes.
We don't have a lot of time to talk about this, but I think it would be interesting to just hear a little bit about this KVN, this kind of network of improv comedy that he was part of. Because, I mean, first of all, you spend a fair amount of time talking about it in the book, and it's really, really quite interesting. And in particular, the way in which this had kind of a role to play, you say, amid the ruins of the Soviet Union, that this KVN network, in a sense, was hearkening back to earlier and more prosperous days. Talk a little more about how this all functioned and kind of what it said about this part of the world at this point in time.
Yeah, so KVN was a Soviet invention. It's a league, like a sports league, of teams of comedians who compete against each other in front of a jury, and the jury decides which one is the funniest, and the funniest teams move up into the next stage of the competition, right, until finally you get a champion, the funniest team in the entire Soviet Union. So it functions something between, you know, a kind of stage act of improv and a sports league. And when the Soviet Union fell apart and all of its constituent republics went their own way, formed their own independent countries, the KVN League as a kind of comedy circuit survived. And it continued to function as a kind of cultural glue for the former Soviet republics to communicate with each other, to stay within the kind of Russian-speaking matrix of culture, entertainment, rather than drifting, as many people were at the time, toward the West, toward Hollywood movies, toward Western music. So this KVN Comedy League continued to exist on all of the television channels and television networks of the former Soviet republics. And Russia, the government in Russia and the television channels in Russia continue to very actively promote it as a kind of, you know, cultural soft power, right? To continue to give the Russian-speaking countries of the former Soviet Union some reason to gravitate toward Russian culture, toward Moscow. When Vladimir Putin, came to power in 2000, he was very wise to the value of this as a kind of a gravitational force culturally to keep these countries like Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Moldova, you know, all of the former Soviet republics, to keep them within Moscow's kind of cultural gravitational pull. And he was quite supportive of this comedy league, you know, throughout his career. It still exists. So President Zelensky, when he was involved in it in his teenage years, he faced this. He was a part of this kind of system. And within that system, he confronted an interesting kind of Russian chauvinism that he and his wife described to me in quite interesting terms, and they're described in the book in some detail. But very briefly, the way it worked in this comedy league is the Russian teams were always kind of favored by the judges. The teams from Moscow always got a little bit of an advantage, an unspoken advantage, while the ones from countries like Ukraine, on the periphery of the former empire, were treated, as Zelensky's wife put it to me, as, quote, slaves. So they were talked down to. They were forced to kind of prove themselves constantly as deserving to be in the major leagues of this comedy circuit, which was of course headquartered and centered in Moscow.
Right.
So it was an interesting dynamic that then played out, you know, in far more dramatic and tragic ways as Russia attempted by other means to keep control over its former satellite states. But the KVN Comedy League was also a way for Russia to achieve that through culture, through comedy, through entertainment.
Hmm. One thing I really appreciate about your book is that you do not settle for brief and simplistic summaries. So, for instance, you know, if I were to ask you what kind of a comedian was Zelensky, that differed from time to time and from situation to situation. And although in the KVN a lot of it was relatively wholesome and relatively goofy in some respects, then he made another move, and the kind of comedy he was doing became much more hard-edged and much more overtly political. And then you tell us about something that occurred in Ukraine that some of our listeners have heard about, known as the Orange Revolution in 2004, and Zelensky made a really interesting choice in terms of how to use his comedy and whether to sort of pick a side or try to remain, in a sense, politically neutral. I just appreciate the fact that first of all, you treat his comedy as seriously as you do, and that you help us understand, I think, in talking about this, how his gifts as an entertainer could be used in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, I think that period of his life when his comedy took on a harder edge began when he left Moscow in frustration. He had competed in the major leagues of KVN, this comedy circuit, and his team never became the champions. And he left in 2003 in frustration, returned to Ukraine to kind of try to make his mark in a smaller pond in the Ukrainian show business world. And he formed a production company, started producing stage acts, variety shows for television. And right around that time, the following year, 2004, the Orange Revolution breaks out. And the Orange Revolution is the first major geopolitical event that really forces Ukraine to kind of pick a side between Russia and the West. And the revolutionary forces there were trying to pull Ukraine closer to the West, to integrate with the West. Russia was trying very hard to stop them. So you had different political actors on the Ukrainian scene, either siding with the Russians or siding with the West. It was quite a dramatic standoff involving tens and hundreds of thousands of people in the streets, you know, protesting for Western integration against Russian influence. But the approach that Zelensky took was to try to steer a kind of middle ground. He didn't want to, with his comedy, insult or alienate either side of that political divide. And honestly, that was for primarily financial reasons, because his comedy, his production team, his production company had investors and partners both in Ukraine and in Russia. It had audiences both in Ukraine and in Russia, and it was trying to speak in the Russian language to both countries. So it couldn't really afford to alienate one side or the other. What he did as a apparent compromise was to make fun of the individual heroes, the leaders of the revolution, the leaders of the kind of pro-Russian camp and the pro-Western camp, but not to take any real position one way or the other on which side was right ideologically. His comedy remained fairly non-ideological, but it was more takedowns of the individual politicians involved. He became the scourge of politicians, and his comedy would just skewer them, you know, with impersonations, with spoofs, with sketch acts, and relentlessly, to the point where you know, some of the politicians tried to buy his loyalty, tried to bribe him to not satirize them as harshly as he did. It wasn't successful, and he became a kind of, you know, conscience of the country over the years. He and his partners in the comedy troupe, because they would speak sort of what they perceived to be with the voice of the people, the way the people perceived their politicians, making fun of them, pointing out their weaknesses, pointing out their flaws, and this is what over time made him a kind of a political voice that was very powerful in Ukraine even before he went into politics.
We're speaking with Simon Schuster about his book, The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader of Vladimir Zelensky. Your book goes on in a chapter titled Annexation to give us a sense of when Zelensky first began to speak more overtly in political terms. I mean, he just felt like he had to with Russia's annexation of Crimea and so on. But it's one thing to do that as an entertainer. It's another thing to decide that one should shift gears professionally and actually become a politician, go into politics. Tell us about this move that Zelensky ultimately made, and what were the forces that were driving him, in a sense, to leave the world of entertainment behind, or at least leave his identification as an entertainer for this other role in his country's life?
Well, all of this happened against the background of the Russian, increasingly violent Russian attempts to keep control over Ukraine. So in 2014, we have Russia annexing the region of Crimea from Ukraine, using troops to seize and occupy that peninsula, then starting a violent war in eastern Ukraine for control of two eastern Ukrainian regions, using separatist proxies and just funneling troops and weapons into those regions to try to break them away from the control of the central government in Kyiv. And President Zelensky, then just a comedian, is seeing all this and increasingly finding it impossible to stay on the sidelines, to stay neutral. So the first thing he does is he cuts off all contact with his business partners in Moscow. That is a very painful thing financially. It costs him about 80% of his company's income and a huge portion of his audience, which was in Russia. Russia and Ukraine, but he sort of began to essentially cut off his business ties with the Russian market. At the same time, he begins touring the front line. So, as I just mentioned, you know, there was a separatist conflict that began in 2014, where you had Ukrainian troops fighting Russian proxies in the east. So, at that same time, the summer of 2014, President Zelensky and his comedy troupe, they begin touring the front lines, you know, similar to Bob Hope and the USO tours, right, during World War II, visiting the military, the front, visiting military bases and entertaining the troops, trying to lift their spirits. And over the course of those experiences, as I sort of describe in the book, you know, some of the specific concerts he gave, some of the specific conversations he had with soldiers, they start suggesting to him, first of all, that the leadership in Kyiv is very inept, that the way that they're waging this war against Russia at the time in 2014 is almost criminal in its abuse of the military forces, in its corruption. So he begins to take a very negative view of the leadership, the political leadership, to criticize them much more harshly in his comedy, but also to see them as, you know, the wrong set of leaders for Ukraine. And pretty early, members of his troop and some of the people he's interacting with, you know, in among the soldiers, they begin to suggest to him, why don't you go into politics? You've been making fun of politicians all your career. Why don't you give it a try yourself? Really soon after that, right around that time, he begins working on a new sitcom for Ukrainian television that really forces him to imagine himself in the role of president. The sitcom is called Servant of the People. And he is in the starring role playing a high school history teacher who, by accident, essentially, stumbles into the role of president, becomes president by accident. It's a pretty funny show. Went on for, I think, three or four seasons. In the course of writing the scripts for that show, it really forced Zelensky to think about the possibility of him actually becoming a president in real life. Mm. Members of his troop began to talk about this more and more seriously, and over time they said, well, why don't we give it a shot?
Mm. And by the way, one of the things you tell us, among other things, is you tell us about when he kind of made that decision that this is something he was going to pursue. And it was many, many months later, maybe a year or more, before he finally let his wife know. I mean, his wife was almost the last person to know about his serious run for the presidency of Ukraine. One question I just want to ask you quickly about this. One of the things you tell us about his campaign is Zelensky conducted the campaign on his own terms, and it left him nearly impervious to political attacks. Just summarize for us the ways in which he went about this campaign and, in some ways, some brilliant choices that he ultimately made that ultimately led to his success.
Yeah, so his comedy was his campaign. He made a point, quite consciously, he and his political advisors, not to take any firm positions on the hot-button issues of Ukrainian politics. They kind of made him a blank slate. They didn't publish a detailed electoral platform. For a long time, they refused to participate in any debates or really meet any of the other candidates in the traditional arena of politics. Instead, Zelensky continued doing comedy. He continued doing variety shows on stage. He continued releasing and producing the sitcom, Servant of the People, where he played the president on television. And what that allowed him to do is to absorb and deflect any criticism. So there was one instance when a particular news channel in Ukraine was harshly criticizing him. And what he did on the stage, I saw this act in Kyiv at the time, he satirized the television hosts who were criticizing him. He made a spoof, and his fellow comedians impersonated them quite harshly and made them look quite stupid. So as a way of deflecting and deflating criticism, that was very clever, and it drove his rivals insane. And they were complaining to the Central Election Commission, the regulatory body, saying this is not fair. He has more airtime than us. He's using unfair tactics to campaign, and you know they had a point, but ultimately, you know, the regulatory authorities said it's fair game. He's a comedian. What do you want to do? Force him off the air. It was a very clever campaign. It was very unconventional, to put it mildly, and it led to an incredible victory. He won ultimately the second round with 73% of the vote. Absolute landslide.
Hmm. So one of the things that he was not able to do was to broker some kind of agreement with Russia. And I'm curious, from your perspective as someone who knows this region so well and knows Zelensky quite well, what would be at the heart of, I don't know, is it too harsh to call that a failure? I suppose in some respects that is what it is, but maybe it was something that absolutely could not have ever been attained under any acceptable circumstances. But what would you say was at the heart of how that proceeded?
Yeah, whether it's a failure or not is a matter of still very, very harsh debate. I'd say he did fail in an important sense. So he promised, his number one promise going into office and campaigning for the presidency was to end the war in eastern Ukraine, this war that began in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea and the separatist conflict that Russia fueled and in many ways waged in eastern Ukraine for control of these regions. By the time Zelensky went into politics, more than 10,000 people had already been killed in that conflict in eastern Ukraine. Millions of people had been displaced and forced to leave their homes. So he promised right off the bat to end that war, whatever it took. He promised to negotiate with Vladimir Putin, and it was clear that he was willing to grant concessions that his predecessors were not, in terms of, you know, finding a way to end the war. You know, even if Ukraine had to take some steps in Russia's direction and granting more autonomy, for example, to these contested regions in the east and so on. I think one thing he miscalculated on, and his advisors were very clear and honest in talking to me about this, he thought that he could charm Putin. He thought that he could use his skills as a communicator to break through that ice in Putin's eyes that we've all seen on television over the years. And that was naive. I think President Zelensky realized it was naive after his first round of negotiations with Putin in, I believe it was December 2019, so toward the end of his first calendar year in office. He met with Putin in Paris, a round of talks that was mediated by Germany and France, and he hoped to break the ice, to use his charm that had never failed him before. But sitting across from Putin at that negotiating table, his skills as a communicator, he found their limits. They failed him. Putin was irritable. He was angry. He came carrying all the baggage and all the grudges from his previous relationships with Ukrainian leaders and politicians, and he had no patience or time for Zelensky's promises to do things in a new way or to negotiate. There was about a year where they attempted to find some common ground, but it pretty quickly failed.
Russia, of course, engages in a full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, 2022, and there are certainly all kinds of indications that Zelensky did not see this happening, I mean, despite being given repeated warnings. What would be at the heart, do you think, of Zelensky's failure to appreciate the seriousness of this threat and to help his country be better prepared for it?
I mean, you know, hindsight is always 20/20. I think to many people in Ukraine, the majority of Ukrainians, most of the journalists I know who cover the region, the idea that Russia would launch a full-scale invasion of Ukraine with tanks approaching Kyiv, you know, bombardment from the air of Ukrainian cities, this seemed utterly insane and implausible. Very few people believed that it would happen. The people who believed it would happen, for the most part, at least among the journalists I know, were primarily the ones who were based in Washington and listening mostly to their sources in the Pentagon and in the U.S. intelligence community. The Kyiv and Moscow press corps, who were familiar with the terrain, who had reported on Putin and his style as a leader, generally pretty cautious, not prone to such you know extreme violence in the past. You know, barring certain exceptions, he had never attempted an invasion on this scale. Nothing near it. So it seemed quite implausible to me, and indeed to President Zelensky, that this would happen. One of the main reasons is that it seemed absolutely clear to me and also to the president that if Putin did this, the Ukrainians would fight back, and that the military forces of Ukraine had evolved and grown much stronger over the previous 8 years of war in eastern Ukraine, that they would put up a hell of a fight, and it would be very messy and very ugly for the Russians. But apparently Putin had faulty intelligence that led him to make this catastrophic decision. Those were the primary reasons. I think the intelligence that Zelensky was receiving from his allies leading up to the invasion was a little bit contradictory. Again, the Americans were saying, shouting from all the rooftops that the Russians are about to invade. This, look at the satellite images. This is how they're going to do it. This is where they're going to come from. And the American intelligence turned out to be basically 100% correct, even down to the detail of how the invasion was going to unfold. But the Europeans, the French, the Germans, had somewhat different ideas. The French and the German leaders were talking to Putin, and Putin was assuring them, no, I'm not going to invade. And they gave him the benefit of the doubt to some extent. And they also told Zelensky, look, we talked to Putin. It doesn't seem like he's going to go that far as trying to seize Kyiv. So Zelensky kind of chose to believe one set of intelligence rather than the other. He chose to lean more toward the European point of view, which was, not convinced that Putin would go as far as he did, and to kind of take with a grain of salt the American intelligence, which was trying to inform Zelensky that this is coming.
Hmm. So when the invasion occurs, of course, one of the most pressing, urgent choices facing Zelensky and his closest advisors was whether to stay or whether to leave. And you write at one point, this is in the chapter titled Daybreak, no one could tell in those first hours of the invasion whether Zelensky and his team would stick around. The military and intelligence services spent months gaming out scenarios for the invasion, but their projections could never resolve that question. Would the president panic? Would the fear of death scramble his ability to lead? Of course, Zelensky famously and in dramatic fashion makes the decision to leave. And not only that, but to communicate that decision to remain, to communicate that message powerfully in the moment. Tell us about this crucial decision and what was behind it, and all of his life experience that allowed Zelensky to, in a sense, embrace this moment in the way that he did.
Yeah, this decision is described, in some detail in the book that I don't think we have much time to go into here. The bottom line of it, I think, for me, is that a core part of President Zelensky's character, going back to his earliest years as a showman, as an actor, as a comedian, he was addicted to the applause. I call it in the book the actor's malady, the need to be to get that reinforcement, that support from the stage, the applause, the adulation, to have the audience find your jokes funny. You know, this is something that I think defines many show people, actors, comedians. They need to have that constant reinforcement, especially from the stage and connecting with their audience. And that was certainly true of Zelensky. He needed to be loved by the audience. Now, if you think about that quality, that personality trait, it has a flip side. It means that being rejected by your audience, being rejected by the people you're performing for, is especially painful. I would argue. And I think that pushed Zelensky to stay and fight, because the shame and the rejection that would have come with fleeing, running away, was to him worse than death, worse certainly than the risk of death that he faced. And it's an interesting, kind of debate that we can have, trying to put Zelensky kind of on the psychotherapist's couch here. But that's ultimately the conclusion that I came to in the book. It's described, in much more detail and fleshed out a lot more. But that's essentially my point of view.
Absolutely. One other quick question, if I may. As Zelensky takes on this important role of beseeching the West for assistance which is given only very haltingly in the early going, he, of course, is ultimately able to raise his own profile as an example of courage on behalf of his people, and the leaders of the West begin to respond differently. And you describe in your book how there were Western leaders who were anxious to have photo ops with this incredible, inspiring symbol of courage. And Zelensky very wisely realized that this could be something that he could use in a really intriguing way, and that in a sense he was not going to give away free selfies with Western leaders. Tell us more about the way in which this really helped play into what he needed, the kind of help he needed for the people of Ukraine.
Yeah, he and his team realized from the very first hours and days of the invasion that they could not survive and fight this war without a massive influx of Western military aid and financial aid. So they used the skills they had, primarily as entertainers, as showmen, as communicators, to try to convince the world to stay on Ukraine's side, to convince not only the leadership of democratic countries, but the people in those countries who elected those leaders, that Ukraine needs their support. Ukraine is the good guy, and that it's fighting this fight for the good of all democracies around the world. And they were very deliberate, strategic, and smart in the messaging, the way they delivered the messaging, the way they crafted it. You know, when I was talking to them, you know, as these events were playing out, you know, they often talked about it in terms of, you know, script writing. You know, we need a hero. In our case, that's President Zelensky. We need a bad guy. This is how we're going to cast them. The real events around them made that quite easy, because this was a conflict of clear aggression on the side of Russia, genocidal atrocities on the side of Russia, and a kind of a country trying to defend itself, a democracy trying to defend itself. So the fact, the kind of the narrative that they were pushing had the benefit of being true. But the way they delivered it was quite skillful in the sheer force of the messaging that he delivered through every available medium, you know, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, television, press conferences. I mean, he was everywhere. And he, you know, even down to the clothing that he wore helped make him almost a caricature of courage. This kind of uniform that he developed with the green T-shirt, right, that everybody now is familiar with, this made him a symbol of resilience in a way that was deliberate, not accidental.
Exactly.
And it encouraged many European leaders not only to support Ukraine, but to try to be near the aura that President Zelensky began to exude in those first days, weeks, months of the invasion. And by April of 2022, when it became safer to visit Kyiv, when the Russian troops withdrew from that region of Ukraine, and it became safe enough for Western leaders diplomats and politicians to visit, they began coming in droves. I mean, I was there, you know, in the presidential compound most of those days at the time, and there was never a day when there wasn't another delegation coming. They would all bring their own press corps from their own countries to document their journey to Kyiv, to document them visiting Zelensky, visiting the site of atrocities the Russians had committed, standing next to him. So it became this kind of, you know, a carousel of visiting leaders. And of course, every time they came, President Zelensky would tell them, "We need your support. You know, you are coming here. You're showing your moral support, but we also need weapons. We need money, and we need you to stand up in the context of NATO, the European Union, the United Nations, and support Ukraine." And that was very effective. I mean, effective beyond what I think anyone imagined, and I would argue what any other leader from another walk of life would have achieved without the skills of communication that Zelensky has.
That's right, as well as adaptability. You tell us that was also a skill from his entertainment days that served him well, and at the same time, you talk about how that lack of adaptability on the Russian side was one of a number of reasons why this invasion has not played out as successfully as Putin and his closest advisors might have imagined. And your book, I want to make sure our listeners understand, is an incredible chronicle of how this invasion proceeded, and Zelensky and others in his government, what they did and where they did it from, and how they proceeded step by step in trying to make the most of a terrifying and incredibly difficult situation. We, of course, do not know at this point how all of this is going to end. But if it is possible for this to end with a Russian withdrawal and for Ukraine to remain Ukraine with Zelensky in power, you raise an intriguing point, which is that in the necessity of war, at least that is Zelensky's perspective, he has taken on a great deal more power than he had at the outset when first elected president. And one really interesting question is, how has all of this changed Zelensky? And in that moment where it might be possible to relinquish some of this control, is that going to be possible for him to do? It's a really intriguing question, isn't it?
It is. And I think history, you know, the lessons of history show that it's very difficult for a leader to part with the kinds of extraordinary power that President Zelensky now has. He has it legitimately. So under martial law in any country, power shifts from democratic institutions to the executive, to the commander-in-chief. That was true of the United States in World War II. It's true of any country at war. But different leaders handle the transition back to peacetime, back to democracy differently. And it often is addictive, that power that a leader gets at a time of war. You know, some things that Zelensky has done has led me to worry, such as his control over the media. You know, at a time of war, all television channels are treated as critical infrastructure. In Ukraine, that has been the case. So since the beginning of the invasion, all the television channels in Ukraine have been showing essentially a state-approved broadcast. It's called the United News Telemarathon, a kind of telethon of news that is dictated essentially by the president's office to a large extent. You know, Zelensky has defended that approach, and he says that's going to remain the case as long as we are at war, as long as there's a threat to our existence. You know, parting with that, I think, will be difficult for him, in part because how important it is for him to maintain control, to be able to maintain control of the narrative within the country, outside the country, and the power he has has allowed him to do that much more effectively. Parting with it is going to be hard. That would mean essentially giving control of the televisions back, the television stations, back to the Ukrainian businessmen, oligarchs, billionaires who controlled it previously, people who are not Zelensky's fans for the most part, who criticized him viciously before the invasion on their television channels. So it's hard for me to imagine, just taking that example again of the media, how easy it will be, how he will handle that transition back to a state where Ukraine is a vibrant democracy, a very a vocal arena and a loud arena of opinions. That's going to be tough. That's going to be tough for him. You know, my conversations with him helped kind of put me at ease that he understands that, you know, if he wants to continue on the path to joining the European Union and NATO, he's going to need to prove his democratic bona fides. And also, to be honest, the fact that he worked with me and allowed me the access that I needed to write this book is also kind of encouraging in the sense that he respects the work of independent journalists and the writing and the chronicles that we produce. So he respected it at least enough to let me do my job. So that's a good sign, I think. But we'll see. We don't know how that's going to go.
Author Simon Schuster, in a morning show conversation recorded early in 2024. His book, The Showman, Inside the Invasion That Shook the World and Made a Leader. The leader in question, of course, Vladimir Zelensky, the leader of Ukraine. The book is published by William Morrow & Company. I'm Gregory Berg. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with a faculty colleague of mine from Carthage College, Lisa Franklin. Her area of specialty, product management. That's a turn of phrase that a lot of us have maybe heard but know nothing about. We don't understand really what it is or why it is important. So we'll get a lesson from Lisa Franklin tomorrow on The Morning Show. Also, I'll be speaking with Tanisha Moore, who is the author of a truly lovely new children's book called Wash Day Love. billed as a joyful intergenerational love story celebrating black hair, self-care, and cultural pride. And then on Wednesday's morning show, we'll be talking about Jazz Week at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, which is coming up next week, beginning on Monday,